Chapter 2, Starting Out. In this chapter, I talk about choosing a name for your company, making your market care about you, and standing up to your mom. Sometimes kids ask me questions on the Ask Gary Vee show, and I'm always struck at how much they take all the opportunities at their fingertips for granted. Of course they can get 2,000 views for their makeup shows shot in their bedroom. Of course they can reach out to seasoned entrepreneurs and ask him a question directly. Every time I see their happy, hopeful faces, I want to scream. Do you know how lucky you are? Do you know how much closer I'd be to owning the Jets right now if I had access to the internet at your age? My God, the things I could have done. And now more people than ever are doing those things, because that's the kind of change the internet has brought to our society. It's why so many of us can start building something incredible, even when we're just sitting at a makeshift desk in a broom closet. It's why we're able to talk to each other, network, reach influencers, find inspiration, and engage at a level unseen in human history. We are all so lucky. It's such an exciting time to be an entrepreneur. Heck, to be a human being. And I'm pumped at how many people are going out into the world with their ideas and their hustle. I get lots of questions from entrepreneurial newbies and restarters looking for everything from nuts and bolts platform explanations to reassurance that they've actually got what it takes to succeed. I try to answer as many as I can because if there's anyone I know I can help, it's this group. I often say there are two core things that bring people value. One, entertainment. And two, utility. I know this chapter falls in the latter category, and not only for the entrepreneurs just starting out. Old-timers, pros, and established icons don't pass up on the opportunity to see what's on the mind of the new generation. Even if you think you already know all the answers, you might be surprised. And their questions, not to mention their eagerness, their fears, and their sheer excitement, can be good reminders to why we decided to hop on this awesome, crazy train in the first place.
Hey, this is Dave Ramsey, nationally syndicated talk radio host. Thanks for having me, folks. Finding a marketing job out of college is tough, especially one that's not sketchy. How do you find a job that is the right fit?
Marketing jobs that are sketchy are funny to me. I'm going to start there because it's a really funny way to put it. I was blown away once I made the transition from wine retailer to the marketing world, because I was the marketer of the wine business, and I didn't realize there was so much low kind of brow, negative connotation around marketing. I didn't realize that there was these industries, MLM, $50 ebooks, mastermind groups that attracted people that maybe didn't have the best intentions for the people that were using their products. And not everybody in that industry, but I think that's clearly where this question's going. You know, I didn't know that an internet marketer was a bad thing. That's what I thought I was. And I've came to learn in the mid 2000s that that's the case. To answer the question, I think internships is a great place to go. And when I say internships, I think you have to be very strategic about this. Too many people are taking internships at good marketing companies because they have great names, but then they end up schlepping coffee all day for the whole summer. Finding that right balance of a company that's growing and is doing new and interesting stuff, whether in virtual reality or social media, that really is going to allow you to taste things and do things instead of just schlep papers around, is very important. There's another one, and this one's going to hurt people's feelings. But I think about D-Rock and what he did to get a job at VaynerMedia. He did spec work. It was free. This is a real debate with a lot of my friends. They don't think that people should do things for free. But I always tell them, right, people that are getting paid and are doing well shouldn't do anything for free. But if you're sitting at home and sending resumes for 18 hours a day and just sitting on your butt, going out and doing what you want to do for somebody for free may show them that they may want to hire you. That's exactly what happened with D-Rock. And that's what's happened a million times over with designers and service-based businesses every day in every country around the world. What that leads me to is the mentality. We have to become a lot less entitled. The market, my friends, maybe your parents, but the market doesn't care that you went to a good university and got a great diploma. The market does what the market does. And so you have to go out and earn it. If you can do that by the pedigree of what you did in school, God bless. But if you can't, you need to go out and hustle and actually do it. And you need to work for free, and you need to network, and you need to just go and get what's yours.
How or should the length limitations inherent on Twitter, Vine, Instagram affect a startup when choosing its name?
It should not. And let me tell you why. First of all, I have many friends. Kevin Rose, big shout out, founder of Digg, one of the great internet entrepreneurs. If he was doing this audiobook, he would probably pontificate for the next 4 hours about how important a name is. So everybody has a different view on this. But for me, the name doesn't matter. A name becomes what you make it. What did Google mean to anybody? What did Starbucks mean to anybody? And you're also, let's not forget, talking to a guy whose last name is Vaynerchuk, right? Not the greatest name ever given for brand. Not to mention one of the interesting mistakes, and I'm going to call it a mistake, I made in my career was I used the username Gary V with two silent E's. When I registered for Twitter, it was the first time I ever did it. And of course, the business gods made that the platform that kind of made me. And so now I run around the world where I say the word, oh, follow me on Twitter at Gary V. And then I have to say with two silent E's, it's silly. It's bad branding. But there is no way in heck that you should choose a name predicated on what some future social network is going to allow you to do by using that name. You need to stop being crippled by that. I know so many startups that spend months with their name and weeks on their actual business.
What was the hardest thing about starting up VaynerMedia from scratch?
I started VaynerMedia in 2009, May of 2009, with my brother AJ. And as I rattle these off, it will remind many of you who followed me where I said, I think in Crush It, my first book, that there's never a bad time to start a good business. So let me rattle it off. Here's what made it hard. Number one, leaving day in and day out operations of Wine Library, the only business I ever knew, the family business that gave us the American dream, working side by side with my dad every day. My best friend worked there. My brother-in-law worked there. So leaving the only family I had outside of my family was extremely hard. Number two, starting a business with another family member. This was my 11-year younger brother, really the love of my life at that point. And the thought of, what if this doesn't work? What could it do to our relationship? Is crippling to many of you, and it's the reason so many of you did not start a business. But obviously, the experience of building a business with my dad gave me hope, and so I went there. There are several other things. Misha Vaynerchuk, my amazing daughter. She was born the same month that we started VaynerMedia. It was the time I became a first-time father. Balancing that was an extreme challenge, and intriguing timing, to say the least. Also, Crush It, my first book, came out that October, and it went viral. Multi-weeks in the New York Times bestseller list, everybody pulling at me, asking me to speak. The brand of me had just been formed at a much higher level, and I had to balance all these opportunities of becoming a personal brand versus running a client service agency. There was two other intriguing factors. Number one, nobody wanted to buy social media advice and content in 2009. I was selling something that was in the future, and all the people that I was pitching didn't even understand what I was talking about, let alone know how to price it or buy it. And finally, the economy sucked. It had just collapsed. People's budgets were bad. People were still scared. There was a lot of tough things in starting VaynerMedia.
How much of success is confidence? How much is skill? And how much is luck? You seem to have a lot of the first.
I sure have a ton of confidence. And let me tell you where it comes from. My mom instilled so much self-esteem into my body that I literally think I can fly. Now, is that luck? Maybe I'm lucky that I was born to that woman. So it really depends on how you want to look at this. A lot of my entrepreneurial friends get really mad at me for even acknowledging luck. But I do. I was born in the Soviet Union. which is the least capitalistic place in the world. And I was born there during the Cold War, and no Russians were leaving Russia back then. But because of a ironic deal between the U.S., Israel, and Russia, I was able to leave the Soviet Union, one of the first groups of people that were able to leave, and I landed in America, the most entrepreneurial and capitalistic place. So is it lucky that I was traded for wheat? Because I was traded for wheat. That was the deal. People for wheat to the Soviet Union. I would say yes. So I have to acknowledge that. Now, all the people that say, you're lucky, you're lucky, you're lucky, piss off people like me and my friends because we actually worked. My skill was crafted since I was 5 years old. Was it lucky that I stood in front of a lemonade stand at 6 years old for 15 hours a day? Was it lucky that at 12 years old I used to go to baseball card shows every weekend instead of playing sports or going to the movies or kissing and playing spin the bottle? Was that luck? Absolutely not. So it's a blend of everything. But I do believe that confidence is a stunning aspect of this. I'm shocked by how confident I'm never scared in running a business. And in other parts of my life, I'm scared all the time. And so I think that's a part of the equation. So I guess it really depends on how you, the listener, are consuming this. How do you see the world? If you want to say that I got lucky because I was born to Tamara Vaynerchuk, then you can say luck. If you want to say skill because I've been honing them for 32 of my 40 years, then you can say skill.
How long is too long for a fiscally responsible entrepreneur to stay in a safe full-time job? At what point do you have to accept that it's not going to happen? Is it ever too late to start?
This question on the show created a firestorm after I answered what I still believe today. So with all due respect to all your collective feedback, I'm going to go there again. If you work in a job, you are not an entrepreneur. Now, I know that hurts, and I'm going to say it again. If you right now, as you're running through the airport or driving on the highway, are going to a job, you, my friend, are not an entrepreneur. You may have entrepreneurial tendencies, but you are not an entrepreneur. Now, let me take a step back, deploy a little humility in the bravado that I'm about to spit. Being an entrepreneur, a purebred entrepreneur, the way that I see it, this is one man's point of view. This is the Ask Gary V book, after all. Is somebody who doesn't even have the ability to have ever had a job. The reason I was an F student, and I'd like to think most of you realize at this point, I'm no dope. I'm not a dummy. It was because I couldn't deploy going through that machine, which was built to go get a job, and I wasn't honing the skills that I knew I had to have to be who I was, and I knew this at 9 years old, at 12 years old, at 15 years old. My junior year of high school, I'm sitting in science class reading The Wine Spectator. I'm doing that because I'm prepping to be a wine merchant because I was an entrepreneur. There was nothing else. If my dad didn't have a liquor store, I would have built on the fact that I was making $3,000 a weekend selling baseball cards in the malls of New Jersey as a 15-year-old. You don't think I could have lived on $36,000 a year for working 52 days a year? I sure could have. And so that's who I was. There was nothing else. Now, a lot of you said this is unfair of me, this, that, and the other thing. What I want you to know is my definition of an entrepreneur should not be yours. You want to think you're an entrepreneur because you do what I said and crush it and come home from 7 p.m. to 2 in the morning and build a business. You want to tell me about the fact that you have student loans and you have to pay them off and that's why you have to do it. I get it, but I would flip it on you. I think an entrepreneur works on their entrepreneurship and then works at 7-Eleven from 11 p.m. at night to 6 in the morning on the graveyard shift if they have to be practical, because you have to understand, and you have to understand, there is nothing else. It's like telling a singer that they can't sing, they have to sing at night. There is nothing else. You're drawn to it. You can't breathe. It is your absolute oxygen. You are an entrepreneur when you are building your business at all times. And let me say another thing. This is not 1992 anymore. It is actually way more practical to be an entrepreneur than it's ever been before. If you are 22 years old, if you are not willing to sleep on the floor with 9 of your buddies in a studio apartment, then you are not an entrepreneur. If you want to get a job because you want a watch or you want a car or you want to be able to take out girls for a nice dinner, then you are not an entrepreneur. An entrepreneur does entrepreneur things, and that is by definition building a business for yourself. Period. End of story.
Hi, guys. This is Pete Brown, and I'm a public safety professional from Connecticut. I want to say thank you, Gary, for all that you do, and ask, Gary, Do you think giving up a secure job for a new and exciting opportunity is irresponsible when you are the sole provider for your family?
Coming off my last answer, this is a really interesting transition because there was something that was said to me as a child by a family member that said, you know, it's a lot harder to go backwards once you have something than when you never had anything at all. And that's why you take so many more risks when you come from a foreign country. We're talking about our family, right? And that's how this one differs from the last question of like, what is an entrepreneur and what isn't, versus you are right now providing for your family. You have kids. You have a life. And now you are going to take a jump into something that is far more high risk. And what I know is two things. You've got to break them down into categories. Number one, for you, especially if those entrepreneurial tendencies are bubbling up and are about to transform you into an entrepreneur, you might be okay with that. You might be okay with going, you know, eliminating Ruth's Chris Steakhouse and eating, you know, a Sonic hamburger. And you might be okay with giving that up. You might be okay with giving up the fancy car to get to something that's a little bit less cool. But boy, when you add that comma and you look at your wife or your husband or you look at your kids, it gets a lot harder. And so when you take on that responsibility to be responsible for other people besides yourself, you have to accept all the things that come along with that. And so I have no interest in tackling this question and being too emphatic in one direction or another. What I would say is, heavy communication with your partner in your life is the key to answer this. You have to be able to be on the same page. If you go and quit your six-figure job to sell pencils on the internet and your husband doesn't think that's a good idea because you were the breadwinner and the high-powered executive, then you may have a conflict if that pencil company doesn't go off and start crushing it immediately. And here's a news alert for all of you. Most businesses don't go crushing it immediately. And I mean the first 2-3 years. I'm not talking about 2 months. And so I would say heavy communication and really having an understanding of the stomach of your family. How much adversity can you guys actually deal with? You've got to audit that before you make this kind of leap.
I love my job, but I want to do my own blog and my own hustle. But I'm crippled when it comes to executing.
You're crippled because you're scared. So now let's take a step back. And I'm going to say it again, actually, because I went through that pretty quickly and it's a pretty intense answer. You're crippled because you're scared. People don't start businesses or their things that they want to do, even though they say it out loud, because deep down they're scared of something. They're fearing it. That's the big jump in entrepreneurship. So I want to focus on this. Who are you scared of? Are you scared of letting yourself down? Or more commonly, are you scared of letting somebody else down? I think one of the most interesting things about a question like this, and so many of you are thinking this, is who are the people in your life that you don't want to let down? Very often, that is your mother or your father or your partner. And so what you have to get over is that. Can you get to a place where you can communicate with them and or make the mental shift in your brain to go and just do it for yourself? It is actually quite hard. I have multiple family members who struggle with doing things for themselves. They pander to the other side, and then you have this, I mean, it really breaks up into two. And then I have family members that do it for themselves, which is, it is what it is. It's our DNA. But I really want to focus on this right now. I really want you to ask yourself. I want you to pause. I want you to pull over on the side of the street right now, because I know so many of you listen in the car. I want you to really stop doing the other thing you're doing while you listen to this. What are you scared of? Because if you're scared of letting yourself down, that's easy. Just do it. I mean, look, you're just going to talk with yourself. But if it's somebody else, if it's your grandpa, if it's your sister, if it's your wife, if it's your husband, go and have that talk. You're being held back and you're going to regret it one day. And the worst thing in the world when you're 70, 80, 90, and 100 is regret. That's the killer. Now, let me tell you something that's kind of interesting, and I'll be naked to you. I have pushed back against being a motivational speaker for the last 10 years of my life. I have built these other companies because I want to remind everybody I'm a good businessman, not just a rah-rah, high-energy guy who writes books and speaks for a living. But I will tell you, I will set aside my own insecurities and concerns for this moment and rant and rave on this one, because if I can will you, if I can will you to tell yourself the truth of what you're scared of, it can fundamentally unlock so much happiness for you. So please, 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 please think about who you don't want to let down, because as soon as you address that, you start the process of doing what's right for you.
What's the best way to deal with someone who's negative about entrepreneurship? What if it's your mom?
If it's your mom, go to your mom and say, screw you. And I'm not joking. And I know that probably just made some of you stop listening to this audiobook, because that is such an aggressive place to go, such potty mouth. I love my mom. I won't say that to you, because you've always supported me. But whether it is a regime from the other side of the world or somebody in your office, there's no difference if it's even your mom or dad. The person that is trying to suppress you, and I've seen it every day of my life, in my own family I've seen it, when that person is trying to make your life worse because of their own fears, sadness, and insecurities, they are not bringing you value. Now, let's take a step back from that aggressive answer. Results. Let's talk about results. There's two ways to address mom or anybody else that doesn't believe in you. You have a conversation, and you take it in one of two directions. You go combative, like I just told you to, and you set the tone, and you draw the line in the sand, and now you're gonna battle, right? That's the battle. Or you go a little bit more practical and diplomatic, and you talk about results. And this one might scare you even more than telling your mom to F off. You go to your mom, and you explain, Mom, you do not believe in me. I believe in myself, so here's what's going to happen. I'm going to do this business, and in 5 years, one of us is going to be right. And that's the game. So many of you are actually not mad at mom because you're scared and you don't believe in yourself. So meritocracy will rule. You can have the combative conversation, or you can have the practical conversation that plays itself out over a 5-year window.
How do you make your market embrace your product or ideas when it just doesn't care about them yet?
The real answer to this question is, you don't. And this is painful for a lot of people to hear, but the number one reason that I believe that I've been successful in my career over the wine industry and the marketing agency is because I do not sell to somebody who is not sellable. I have no interest in convincing people that my product or service is good enough for them to sell on it if I already know that they have absolutely no interest in it. So what I do is I find the small group of people who actually do want to buy it and do believe in it. So early on with VaynerMedia, nobody wanted marketing services around social media. So I went to a lot of meetings that were scheduled for an hour. I would start my presentation. I could literally taste in the room that this was not going to happen. And I would, and this is not a joke, I would end them very early. Instead of spending the whole hour, I would wrap it up in 20 minutes. I would buy back my 40 minutes. I would be cordial. I wasn't rude, but I just knew it wasn't going to happen. And I needed all of those 40 minutes back to find the next person that I could talk to see if they were actually interested. Listen, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you think you made the best t-shirt or the best lollipop or the best tires in the world. The market gets to decide. Most companies go out of business because they try to sell to people that aren't sellable to. So the answer is you don't. You just have to read if you have a potential sale. And if you don't, you have to move on.
Hey, guys, this is Chef Lizette, CEO of Chef Lizette Entertainment, encouraging folks to using good food as the catalyst to living your best life, one dish at a time. And here's my question for the Ask Gary V book. When trying to create a new media property, say something at the intersection of food and tech with no real precedence, how do you find and forge the right partnerships? For example, people with resources and access.
So one of the things I think about quite a bit when it comes to partnerships and business development is why so many people suck at it. See, they start at a zero place. Let's say you don't have a property, and you start looking at the people that do have access and leverage and audience, and you default into saying, boy, if I could just do a deal with that person, or boy, if they just gave me a shout out on Twitter, or boy, if I could just be on their show or podcast, I could get exposure and win. And that's where the whole thing breaks down. You're not thinking, hey, what can I bring to Chris Sacca? Or hey, what can I bring to Gary Vaynerchuk? Or hey, what can I bring to Seth Godin? You're being selfish. The way to do biz dev, the way to really make partnerships, is to actually provide 51% of the value to the other person. Because when you do that, you create leverage. Now you may say, but what would that person want? Chef, let's use you as an example. You're a chef. A lot of people like having private chefs. They pay hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars for it. You may not have an audience or a platform to help people, but you could trade your skill of being a chef to people in return for them giving you exposure of whatever you're trying to do. All of us have something to provide. I'm actually obsessed with the barter economy. I actually think the way we used to do business years and years ago, right, where I'd give you apples from my farm, but maybe you gave me milk from your cows, is actually a far more realistic thing with today's technology, where we're all neighbors and connected on the internet. So here's what business development isn't. It isn't sitting down and then emailing everybody on LinkedIn who has a big profile or a big business and spamming them, saying how great they are and what can they do for you. What it is figuring out what you bring to the world and then presenting it to people that can bring you value in the best form, whether through email or on social media, to give you an opportunity to collaborate. When you are starting at the bottom and somebody else is at the top, not offering them something in return for that exposure is ludicrous. And more importantly, do you really want charity? I didn't think so.
Who would you recommend pitching an app idea to? What steps would you recommend?
I'm going to take advantage of the broadness of this question to talk about how I think about business, which is I always start with the finish line and go backwards. Who would I pitch an app idea to would be predicated on what I want to accomplish. Are you pitching somebody to give you money to actually build it? Are you pitching a co-founder because you don't know how to develop an app, but you need somebody to make it for you? Are you pitching it to sell it because your app has plateaued after 3 years and you'd like to exit and execute another idea? And I'm going to break those all down. How do I recommend going about it? By asking. Tenacity is underrated. I'm not talking about spamming. I just referred to that earlier. I don't mean go into LinkedIn and send a blank email, a bulk email to every single VC in the world. But the way to get something in this scenario is to ask. If you don't go to every meetup looking for a co-founder because those developers hang out there, then you're not trying hard enough. The amount of people that piss me off that are always saying, Gary, I don't know how, when it's staring them right in the face. And what they mean is, I don't want to. There's a big difference between I don't know how and I don't want to. And so I would answer this question in all three ways that I set it up by going out and doing it. You are more than welcome to go to AngelList. You're more than welcome to go to TechCrunch meetups. You're more than welcome to show up to all these places in the world, not to mention that you can almost get to anybody by going to Twitter and tweeting at them. You just have to put in the work and do it. And more importantly, you can't be crippled by a no. The amount of people that have done business with me or have interacted with me after asking 16 times on email over 2.5 years is more than I'd like to admit, because it takes tenacity. So what steps should you go to pitch an app? By taking the actual steps.
Hi, this is Dennis Crowley. I'm the co-founder and CEO at Foursquare, the location technology company. And I'm very excited and honored to be reading the next 10 questions in the Ask Gary Vee book. How do I get the first 10 customers for creative service startup?
One of the most viral videos I ever made in my career was me cold calling somebody by randomly just going to Google, searching beer, finding somebody that was buying Google AdWords and advertising beer mugs, calling them and saying that I was going to do a beer show and would they be a sponsor. They kind of alluded to yes, and everybody was shocked and excited that watched that video live as a real transaction happened. I, on the other hand, was massively disappointed by everyone's shock and disbelief that that's how it's done. How do you get your first 10 customers? You literally grind it out. If I was starting a company right now, I would literally ask for every favor from every person I know. I would ask my 8th grade science teacher if he knew anybody who needed a new website, because that's what my shop did. I would go through my entire address book, literally every single person I've ever emailed in the history of my life, and I would send them an email saying, Dear Karen, I started a web shop. Do you need a website or know anybody? I truly believe it is remarkably easy to get your first 10 clients. You just have to go out and do it. And as a matter of fact, if that didn't work after a month of literally asking every human soul I've interacted with, well, then I would just start building them for free and using the work to get me other business. Getting the first 10 customers for a startup or a service-based business literally comes down to effort.
Hey guys, this is Warren Weeks from the Art of the Great Media Interview in Toronto, Canada, and here's my question for the Ask Gary V book. PR firms offer media training for executives, but the quality varies a lot. A lot of companies have grown complacent and just hire the same firms over and over. So how do I get on the radar of decision makers who aren't actively looking, either because of complacency or because they think all media trainers are essentially the same?
First, I just want to say hey to Warren. Warren's one of the book winners. We did a bunch of contests for this book that are going to kind of jump in here and interrupt the rest of the flow from some of our guest readers. So, Warren, good job getting ahead of Dennis here. We'll continue with Dennis shortly. This question is kind, and I, after giving Warren a very nice little thing, I'm going to attack Warren a little bit. Warren, stick with me here. I love you, brother. I know you're a winner, but that kind of sounds like a loser question. It kind of seems very kind of sad, like, oh, woe is me. These companies have done such a great job for 20 years, and now everybody uses them. How do I use them? How do I get that business? Why is everybody using? Everybody's using them because they brand. Everybody's using them because they, at one point, even though you may judge that they vary in quality, they were quality enough for the entire market that they became the establishment. Your job is to become the establishment. It's a mix of some of the prior questions we've done. Maybe you've got to do this media training for free for a high profile person because that's a better price than everybody else can offer and that gets you exposure. Maybe you just need to keep grinding and go to every B2B function, every kind of chamber of commerce event, every conference that happens in Toronto and network, give away your card, and just grind, kind of will yourself to those first opportunities. But to sit here and say that these companies that have been successful for decades get everybody's business and wah, you know, that stinks and I'll never get in is literally loser mentality. There is one other way and a way that I'm very into because it means they're coming to you instead of you're coming to them. If you're so great at executive training or any other skill in the world, why don't you start writing on Medium.com or on LinkedIn? Why don't you start pontificating and giving your points of view on all these platforms where people can see it and let that content become not viral, but get passed around, sent around, and all of a sudden you might just say something in one blog post that leads to an executive coming to you and saying, hey, you wrote this article on LinkedIn that I thought was very interesting. I'd love to come and talk to you about your point of view on the 6-year plan or whatever the heck you titled your thing. So you gotta do.
Why do you focus on top line revenue?
I focus on top line revenue because it's massively important in the way that I've built both of my businesses in my career. But before I go into it, I want to ground this conversation because I'm not sure everybody understands the context. Let's say you run a $5 million a year business. You might make $2.5 million in profit after your expenses and cost of goods. And then let's say I'm running a business and it's doing 5 million sales and I might only make $1 million in profit because I hired a bunch of other people and things of that nature and because I'm going for growth. Hopefully, if I made less than you, next year I'll do 10 million in sales and you'll do 7.2. That's the thesis. If you're investing in your business, then you're making a little bit less and your goal is your top line sales. And the reason I do this is because you always have time to fix the bottom line. With Wine Library, I kept growing. When I felt the growth was going to stagnate, then I could cut costs and make a lot more money. I find that people that are not thinking about top line revenue are worried too much about how much cash they're making along the way. It's the difference between thinking about becoming rich and becoming wealthy. Sure, you can make a couple more bucks along the way, but if you keep reinvesting it, you have a much better opportunity to build something substantial. I'm always confused when I watch executives or business owners try to take home a lot of money when their business is successful. Because the thing that they don't realize is every business, like every person, has their moments in time. If you're rolling and everybody's into cupcakes of that moment, you know, and your cupcake store is doing super well, that's when you need to triple down. That's when you need to expand, but be practical. You don't want to put yourself out of business, but that's when you want to be on the offense. You can always cut payroll. You can always slow down with your location growth. You can always slow that down. One thing that you can't count on is the market adoring your product and service. And so when that's happening, you've got to go all in because at the net, you'll make a lot more money long term.
I have an app idea with my target market willing to test it, but I need to create the app and I'm not a programmer. Any advice?
What the hell is this question. What do you mean any advice? You need to build it, and there's a million ways to do it. This question really angers me, and I'm not trying to pick on anybody, but the thought of any advice? Yes, you do not know how to program. That means you have to either team up or hire somebody who can build it. That's literally like saying, I have the drawings for a house I want to build. I have the money, but I don't know how to build. You hire a contractor. I mean, this is a silly and really basic question that I hear all the time. And once again, this goes to questions and talking and not actions. This is a very easy answer to anybody that knows anything about business at any point, at any time, which is go and find the person that can help you. If you have no money, because that's what a lot of you are thinking right now. Yeah, great, Gary, but I have no money. Good. Go to meetup.com, go to a programmer's meetup and yell at the top of your lungs. I have a great idea. Does anybody want to hear it? And you can become my 50% partner. Because here's the truth. If you can't build it, it doesn't exist. I also, just to counteract here, just to ramble and rant with you. That's what audio allows you to do. I also hear a lot of people that come to me and say, Gary, I have this big idea. I've heard you talk about creating a co-founder, but I don't want to give him or her any equity, but I have no money to hire anybody. Then I look at them and say, what do you want me to do? I mean, like, great. Like, get out of my office. Go home and keep hoping. Actions speak louder than words. This is an irritating question. I apologize for my energy on this, but like, what do you mean, what do? You go and find somebody to build it. They're either your partner or you pay them. It's very simple. It's the most basic thing in life.
I'm building an app that's probably 6 months away from a working prototype. What would you suggest I start doing now to build it up so that when it's time for release, we'll have plenty of users?
This is a tricky question and one that I think a lot of people struggle with because you spend all your time trying to build the best product. I often say, you know, no great marketing is going to solve your business if your business stinks. If you make a crappy shoe, the greatest marketing in the world isn't going to work. You might get a first-time buyer, but you're going to die. And so I can see how so many of you would then focus on, let's build the product, let's build the product, and then when it launches, then we'll try to get users. As you can imagine, that kills a lot of companies as well. They spend so much time and energy on the product that when it comes time to sell it, they don't have an audience, they don't know what to do about it. And so I applaud you for fixing the plane while you're flying it, that expression. I like that you're trying to build, but you know this moment's coming, so you've got to get ready for it. Let me give you an answer. And the answer is content. Content, content, content. Let me explain. Content, information, right? Words, videos have always been the gateway for awareness around products, whether it's been done through a television, in book form. And we are now living through a world where you can produce content at such a low cost, right? More importantly, distribution of that content was always very important. Lucille Ball was very funny. She was an amazing comedian. But if she wasn't on TV or on radio to have distribution for people to hear her jokes or see her jokes, well, then she would have just been a funny aunt living in a home in Iowa. Distribution matters. We are living through the greatest distribution time of all time, where you don't have to pay for it. You can actually create content using your phone, and then within that same little phone, you can go and start building profiles on Twitter and Facebook and all these amazing places and get distribution. But here's the problem. Are you putting out good content? Because if you're not, you're not going to be found. The talent, the creative, the aspects of that matter. So what I would say is the following. Take a step back and really think about your app. Is your app conducive to putting out interesting content? If it's not, maybe the journey of you and your partner building this app is the content. Maybe you can start doing Periscopes and Facebook posts and YouTube videos and Snapchat stories about your journey. Maybe you call it 6 months away. Maybe that's what your count is. And it's a story of two kids in a basement in Cleveland, Ohio. And every day you're like, today was a bad day. Ricky got sick. And the next day is, today's a really bad day. A company came out with the same exact feature. Today was a great day. And you just start telling the story. Many people didn't think that reality TV was going to work. But the truth is, we love stories. We always have. And you're in control of that. So if I were you, I would start telling either the journey of your entrepreneurial mission and the lead up to the product, or stories around the theme of your product. If I was launching a wine app back in the day, maybe the content would be me tasting wine along the way. And so I would say it's content, content, content.
What's the biggest obstacle to success? Lack of time or lack of capital?
Lack of optimism. Let me explain. Both. And 100 other things. Racism. Bad luck. A moment in time. Let me give you an example. I think about this all the time. When I drive, I never want to look at my phone, because what if that moment, after all these years of doing great things, I look down at my phone and then I hit somebody and it changes my course because I can't wrap my head around me doing this awful deed. It's a second in time. It's a pessimistic view on the world. Lack of money is a problem. Or you can go out and get it. I mean, lack of time is a problem. Or you could go out and make it. I believe the biggest thing holding people back is their outlook on the opportunity and the mission of being an entrepreneur. I can literally sit here for the next 2.5 hours and give you all the excuses to why you can't accomplish your business goal. Or you can look at the glass half full and recognize you're in control of your life. Too many people sit and default into bitching, why not, instead of trying to figure out how come. And that's the truth.
What should I look for in a co-founder?
If you're lucky enough to be self-aware and understand what you're good at, or you've done business for long enough to recognize the patterns of your success, the number one thing that you should look for in a co-founder is somebody that brings complementary skills. The thing I used to always tell my dad was, when we were running Wine Library, is you can't have two cooks in the kitchen. You can't have two creatives. You can't have two foundational financial partners. Somebody's got to do the books. Somebody's got to create the new business. So what you're looking for is what rounds out this team. Having a co-founder means having a partner, which means you're trying to check as many boxes that matter in business. And so I would say what I would look for in a co-founder is somebody who's opposite me in skills, but aligned with me in religion. What I mean by that is we see the world the same way. Let's take care of people. Let's do right by our customers. There's an opening in the asphalt paving industry. We believe in the core things together, yet when we go out to execute that business, we do separate things. We divide and conquer to get there, but we both know what our finish line looks like.
What came first at VaynerMedia, clients or employees? And did you ever do the work by yourself?
I always say that we started the company when my brother AJ graduated, but the truth is we started before. While AJ was on spring break, we started doing a client service execution for a small company. And then 3 weeks before graduation, we flew to Las Vegas and we did an activation. So what happened first was clients. What we had the benefit of was I had a little clout and a little knowledge to the marketplace, and people were coming to me and wanted us to work on social media because of what I did with the wine business. At first, we did all the work. We hired a couple of AJ's college friends, so I guess it's some way you could look at it as what's the chicken and the egg, but the truth is we started the company with capital, and it wasn't capital that we got from investors, and it wasn't capital that I put in. It was the first paychecks from our first clients. So the answer is clients, and I highly recommend to a lot of you, especially based on some of the questions we've already addressed, if you're going to go make that leap into entrepreneur land, it's a hell of a lot better to have check in hand, because it's a lot safer than just hoping you're going to get a customer.
What are your tips for teenage bloggers to show brands they mean business?
By actually having a business. There's way too much audacity amongst my 15-year-old maniacs that think that the reason that brands should work with them is because they're 15. News alert. There's a lot of fucking 15-year-olds in the world, and you all have accounts. And so now the real question is, do you have followers? Do you know what you're doing? Do you have followers because you're cute and you have baby blue eyes and other girls think that you're so dreamy? Or do you have a following because you put out great content and you figured out how to actually storytell on Instagram and Snapchat? Just by saying, hey, Procter & Gamble, hey, Coca-Cola, I mean business, means nothing. It's all about the data. Show me your accounts, show me how many followers you have, and again, show me why you got those followers, because just being cute doesn't sell more soda.
How can I filter years of exciting adventures and experiences into value that someone would actually be interested in?
One of the most difficult things for people in general is to take things from their brain and turn it into something that's consumable. So let's take a step back. First, these exciting adventures, let's first hope that they actually are exciting adventures. You may think they are, other people may not. So let's respect that the market has to believe that to be true. Next, take a step back and think about what kind of communicator do you want to be. So for example, I'm good in audio, I'm good in video, but writing isn't my strength. That's why I need a ghostwriter, right? How do you actually communicate to the world? That's a very important part of this equation. For example, Brandon Stanton, he created Humans of New York. He was a photographer. He captured these amazing images, and then he used Facebook by posting it there and created a group which caught fire and then led to Instagram, which then led to an enormous Instagram following, which led to a book deal, which made him a lot of money, millions of dollars, because he figured out how to talk to the world, which in his way was through a camera, taking a picture, posting it on Facebook when people were paying attention to Facebook, which led to attention. He quickly migrated to Instagram when Instagram became the place where people's attention was. That caught a lot of people's attentions, led into a book form. He monetized it. That is absolutely the key. If you have these amazing adventures, how are you going to tell the world about it? Are you going to start a podcast? Are you going to draw cartoons about it? Are you going to actually sit down and be interviewed? What are you going to do to tell the world about these adventures? What kind of content are you going to create? And then all that attention, if it's so adventurous and so great, leads to incredible business opportunities. It leads to incredible artistic opportunities or whatever else drives you in life.
When you have a new business idea, how long does it take to implement? Do you run with it, strategize for a while, consult with others? Number 11. Now that I've recorded these 10 questions, where do I get my free mozzarella sticks?
Dennis, thanks for being a great sport. For any of you that don't know, Foursquare was one of the iconic apps that came out during the Web 2.0 boom, and Dennis is a father in geolocation technologies and just a great guy. I'll send you the mozzarella sticks, Dennis, when I get a chance. Let me tell you a story, actually, instead of answering this. I gave a speech in Toronto. We were in the Q&A part, as you know, my favorite part. And a young man raised his hand and he said, if I beat you in rock, paper, scissors right now on stage in front of all these people, can you give me 30 minutes for a coffee drink in New York? I said, sure, being the competitive guy that I was. I was convinced I was going to win, and then I was going to stick it to him and never meet him. I was going to actually, I wasn't going to be a nice guy. I was going to beat him, and I was never going to see him again. He beat me. And then months later, I'm looking at my calendar. It's 11 p.m. at night, and I have this name on my calendar for a drink on the Upper East Side where I live. And then I click into it because I don't recognize the name, and I go, oh, crap, this thing. And I was tired, and after an 18-hour day, why am I doing this? That gentleman was Jerome Jarr. Jerome sat down with me and told me that Vine was exploding, the app that had just come out. I agreed with him because I'd been paying attention because VaynerMedia does that kind of work. And then he proceeded to tell me that he'd been following my career and what I did on Twitter he was doing on Vine. Within 3 hours of this conversation, I made a 50-50 joint partnership with Jerome to start an agency to represent Vine celebrities and asked him to fly with me the next morning to Los Angeles. That was the quickest decision to start a business in my career. Many other of my businesses, including VaynerMedia and other things that I've done, have been things I've been thinking about for years before I actually executed them. I would tell you that everybody's different, but what you need to allow is serendipity to happen if you're a true entrepreneur. But being calculated and thinking things through matters very much. At the end of the day, much like parenting, I don't want to spew my point of view on you on this one. This really needs to be about how you roll. But I will tell you this, both the businesses that I've thought about for years and the businesses like Grape Story that I started in a second have both failed and succeeded on the execution, not on how long I pondered them.
Hey guys, it's Al Harrington, former NBA stud for 16 years. And I'm so excited to be reading the next 10 questions in the Ask Gary V book. Thanks for having me. How do you avoid letting a new business run its new social media plan by itself?
Let me first say that I wish I was a 16-year stud of the NBA. I know a lot of you are envious of me being a successful entrepreneur, but I am super envious of that. Al, thanks for doing this. I think the basis of this question is predicated on, look, you have an agency that does social media for companies. How do you convince them to use you and not them? First and foremost, I don't convince them. You know, I'm not in the business of telling people that they shouldn't be doing something. As a matter of fact, I actually think it's crazy to be paid more money to do something that somebody can do by themselves. If I knew how to fix my stuff around the house, I would not hire a handyman because I'd do it myself. So I think at the end of the day, the way I go about it is I remind them that nothing stays still. One of the biggest things that has happened is a lot of companies have hired my company and me because they want to siphon out the strategy out of my head, and then they'll hire their own people to do it. The problem is, Facebook has changed 16 times since I wrote this before I recorded the audiobook. I mean, it's crazy. It's the fastest changing landscape of technology that we've ever seen. So at the end of the day, I don't really try to convince anybody, like I said earlier, that they have to use us. I just let the results speak for themselves. I just make sure we're best in craft of the moment, and the business will come to us instead of convincing somebody or scaring them into thinking that that's the right choice. If you're good enough to do it yourself, don't hire us.
What is the best way to scale a business with an inherently low profit margin?
The number one thing I do in this case is recognize that while I'm running that business with low margin, I have to create another revenue stream with higher margin in parallel. And what I do is I actually take the profits from the low margin and I deploy them on creating a high margin business. Let me explain. Wine Library, my first great work. As a kid, I recognized that people wanted to buy name brands. Santa Margarita Pinot Grigio, Kendall Jackson Chardonnay. These were brands for a reason. I made no margin. We were making nothing. Some of these items we were selling at cost, which meant I wasn't able to deploy anything. So here's what I did. I actually went the other way. Instead of trying to raise my margin on that, I went lower, which brought me more customers. With more and more customers coming to the store, I was able to take more at-bats at selling people on other wines because I was building my craft on learning about other wines from the world that nobody had ever heard of. So you came in because I sent a coupon in the mail for Kendall Jackson at dead cost, and you were going to buy a case, but you left with another bottle from a wine from the south of France or from New Zealand that I was making real margin on. I was using my skills, my learnings, my palate of tasting of other wines in the world as a profit center, but I used my low margin business as a gateway drug. And that's what I would do if I were you. I would not shut down or try to make more profit on the margin on that business. I would create a complimentary service or product that you could leverage off what they're already buying from you.
What is the best piece of advice for a first generation American entrepreneur venturing out on her own away from her family business?
First off, kudos. That is an incredibly, incredibly difficult thing to do and takes enormous amounts of courage. First of all, be practical. You've been in an environment where your family had a business and that probably supported you. So you've always had that in your life. And that's something that takes a little while to get away from. You no longer have mommy's or daddy's business to kind of pay your bills, right? To have that stability. And so you've got to be really smart about your cash flow, your expenses. The last thing you want to do, and I know this for sure, the last thing you want to do is go back to mom and dad and say, hey, I need some help. I screwed up. Next, sacrificing. That business gave you some freedoms, some weekends, some nights to do the things that you wanted to do. In the beginning, you have to make massive sacrifice. It blows my mind that people realize when they have a child that they have to give up 2 years of their lives because they're up all night and this and that. A business is no different. The thought that you're going to start a business and not give up your entire life for the first 2 or 3 years because every hour has to go in there is just a mind-boggling mistake. And number three, and I didn't write this in the book, and that's what's so great about doing the audiobook, you got to keep your head up. One of the most difficult things is to leave a family business because you're being judged by everybody in your family. And they vary. Some family members and parents may be proud. They're proud of you. But many times that's not the case. A lot of times it's met with a lot of cynicism. Oh, what, you think you're better than your brothers and sisters? Or what makes you so special? Or this business is not good enough for you? It's provided for our family. Remember how we came to America? Da, 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 da. Keep your head up. You're only doing exactly what your parents did. And so remind them of that and be proud of that.
Hello, this is Dawn Swick Renshaw, CEO of Stony Creek Social Media, and here is my question for the Ask Gary V book. If you could go back to any time in your life, know then what you know now, when would that be, and what one thing would you change in your business life?
I would go back to the late 90s, early 2000s, and I would do the following. Google AdWords was a new advertising product, no different than how I'm fancying Snapchat right now. Most people didn't know what it was. Most people weren't used to searching anywhere outside of something called Yahoo.com. And there was this new ad product that when you searched, other things could show up that weren't just from the search results. I used this to build Wine Library. It was a big backbone of mine. I bought the word wine for so little, 5 and 10 cents a click, before anybody really realized what was there. The thing that I would do is the following. I would have spent more money on it. What I didn't do at the time was I started buying newspaper ads and radio ads and doing all this other stuff. And what I didn't do back then was understand what the undervalued asset was. Google AdWords was grossly underpriced while newspaper was appropriately priced. I could have built a much, much bigger business if I spent all tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands on Google AdWords instead of half of that there or a third there and direct mail, radio, television, and all the other things that I did. I've learned a lot from that and it's built my all-in mentality when I see something is huge. There's one other thing. Eric Kastner, big shout out, Eric, miss you. He was my developer for Wine Library in the early days. We built a lot of tools to make winelibrary.com very successful, including the ability to email people that had an open shopping cart but hadn't submitted to the checkout. At the time, it was very nice and helped me build my business. I wasn't smart enough to realize that I was building some of the best e-commerce technologies before even companies like Amazon were doing it. And that if I was smart enough and built it as a product instead of using it for my wine business, I could have sold those companies for billions of dollars instead of it helping me make hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I've learned from those two things. And now I do think about when I'm using tactics or doing tactics, can that be a business in itself? That's the difference between 25-year-old me and 40-year-old me. These are the business experiences. My instincts were right, but the learnings have evolved me as a businessman.
What are the biggest mistakes you see young entrepreneurs make?
A lot. Right now, as I talk to you, the market conditions are good. And so we've had a 5 to 7 year window where young entrepreneurs have not had to deal with adversity. So I'm not mad at them. I was a young entrepreneur. I'm not mad at millennials or Generation Z. I'm just sad for them that they've grown up in an era where things have been good, and that means that they're soft. What I mean by that is they're lacking the following things. Patience, the ability to absorb adversity. That what they have is audacity. We've never lived in an era. My friends, let's take a step back. We have never lived in an era because of technology where 40 and 50-year-old executives sit in a room with a 25-year-old and are actually willing to hear their point of view because the 40 and 50-year-old executive is absolutely scared of technology and intimidated by it. There was no scenario in 1994 or in 1986 or in 1962 where the 24-year-old sat in the boardroom with the CEO and had something to say. We live in that environment now because of the respect level that we have for youth and technology. The problem is that's created a false sense of entitlement, and I have a feeling as the economy gets soft, which it will eventually, that we will be seeing a huge exposure of young entrepreneurs who are more wantrepreneurs, who are more number twos, threes, and fours. Because remember, the definition of an entrepreneur is it's your business. And I think a lot of people right now want to be the next Mark Zuckerberg, the next Evan Spiegel, and they are going out and building businesses when they would have been much better complementary parts to an actual entrepreneur. So I think it comes down to classic naivete. They don't know any different. The market's been good, and the way they've been conditioned is for only good times. And with bad times looming, there's going to be a huge exposure.
How do I overcome the perception of being too young when I'm pitching VCs?
I don't accept this. I'm not happy with this question. This is not fair. As a matter of fact, being young is an advantage. Whoever asked me this question on the show is just lacking self-esteem and or is just making excuses for lack of success. There is a magnitude, a stunning amount of 16 to 22-year-olds running all around San Francisco and New York right now raising money on their idea because everybody's chasing the pot of gold. So I don't believe that to be true. And if VCs have told you that you're too young, it means that they weren't willing to spit it to you straight and they used it as an excuse, because the data is the data. And I could show you thousands of companies that are run by 17 to 22-year-olds right now that have raised capital. Period. End of story. Excuse City USA.
As a successful solo entrepreneur, do I have to grow my business bigger than I can handle alone?
I don't know. Do you? I mean, this is a very personal question. But I'm going to try to break it down to bring value to everybody who's listening instead of just making it a one-word answer. The first thing you need to figure out is, what do you want in life? I mean, if you want more money, if you want more challenges, if you want more success, if you want more stress, the answer is yes. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, you want to grow a business that outgrows you so that you can start affording and hiring people. But I'm going to really rant here. I've noticed something over the last 7 or 8 years as somebody who wants to build huge businesses. I've given some bad advice in the last decade of my life. There's a lot of stories I can tell you right now of my friends who were solo entrepreneurs who were making $187,000 a year because they were very smart and found a way to do that. Of that $187,000, a lot of profit, maybe taking home 100 of that because, you know, the cost of goods. And I would push them to build things because that worked for me. And then they would build a business that was doing $380,000, maybe taking home $150,000, but they had 7 times the headaches for 3 times the revenue, and they became unhappy. And so you need to know, are you trying to build a lifestyle business, or are you trying to buy the New York Jets? You've got to understand your own ambition. And by the way, give yourself permission to change your mind, but you have to constantly audit yourself year in and year out, day in and day out. It's okay if you wanted to be small and you enjoyed jet skiing, but then you got bored for 3 years and now you want to go for it and build a $10 million business. And on the other hand, it's okay if you have a $10 million business and you want to scale it back to $6 million because you've got more than enough money, you've got a great house, and now you just want to spend more time with your family. The answer is fundamentally up to you.
What fundamental skill do many entry-level marketers lack?
I don't think it really matters what they lack. I think what you should focus on, everybody who's listening, is what do you have? I mean, the truth is, they lack all sorts of things. They may not know exactly how Snapchat works right now. They don't understand attention arbitrage. They don't understand mobile behavior. They don't know UX and UI, landing page optimization. What's the ROI of social media compared to paid advertising on Google? How programmatic advertising works on the DSPs? You know, why are we converging into a mobile first world and the second screen is actually the television? I mean, the truth is, I could literally talk about a million things. So instead of worrying about what you don't have, why not take a step back and understand what you do have? Because the truth is, no business and no co-founder should expect you to know everything.
How can I converge my vision of being a YouTuber with my parents' vision of me getting a university degree?
My initial instincts are screw your parents and do you, because I mean, I really truly believe in that, because I think if you're successful, then your parents will respect that and you'll win. But I'm going to go in a different direction. It's by only focusing on both. You have a lot of hours in the day. You probably are awake for 17 hours a day. So, in those 17 hours, execute both. You gotta give up hockey. You gotta give up going to the movies. You gotta give up skiing all the time. You gotta give up video games. You gotta give up hooking up with your girlfriend for 6 hours, do it for an hour. You gotta give up everything else but these two things if they matter to you. And you would easily accomplish that, by the way. So stop being so goddamn lazy.
Hey, guys. This is Kevin Asp calling in from Inbound Med up here in the Great White North up in Alaska. A longtime viewer, first-time caller. I have a question for you, Gary. If I have a plan B, does that mean I'm setting myself up for failure? Should I never have a plan B because I should be confident in my plan A? Looking forward to hearing from you, Gary. Thanks. Bye.
Look, I know a lot of motivational coaches and a lot of rah-rah and quotes on Instagram say, if you have a plan B, you're not going to be able to win on your plan A. But I got to tell you, I'm much more practical than that. As much as I love motivation and rah-rah and bravado and ego and confidence, I really think having a plan B is practical and smart and something that you should do. If you take 80% of your energy and deploy it against your plan A, I think it is massively appropriate to have 20% of your energy on plan B. You've got to always think, what if? It doesn't hurt. I am probably the most all-in on plan A's, but I absolutely always think about things like, heck, you know what? Let's take a step back here. Let's transition a little bit. I'm probably reading you this book because I have a plan B. If all my businesses fail, at least I've built a personal brand that I can lay back on and travel the world and speak. And I'd probably be speaking about why I failed at that point. But, you know, the bottom line is I think plan B's are quite important. And it makes me mad who says if you have a plan B, you failed. It's usually people that have already succeeded.